Okay, fun seekers. Oh boy, have we got a great presentation for you. Well, at least we hope so. Were you confused by the share classes in the previous presentation and the different ways you're being charged for mutual funds? Good. We in the industry have done our job. No. I mean, just go over it again and you'll figure it out. Because this presentation is going to be even tougher. Why is that? Because we are just going to scratch the surface. We are going to look at the most prominent, but certainly not the only, categories of mutual funds. There are many other categories and subcategories and subcategories. And so we just need to learn these to be able to then identify, oh yeah, that's a type of this type of mutual fund. Okay. And what I would like you to do is either print it out if you have a big screen, whatever, have it on your screen somehow. The mutual fund scramble sheet. Now, where is that? It's in Canvas. And it's also on the website under mutual fund scramble sheet. There's a little commentary on there, but let's take a look at it. It's meant to be printed for the online students. In the face-to-face class, we actually build it on the whiteboard in front of the class. And then when I started teaching online, I said, well, maybe we need this a copy of it. And I really should redo it. But there, it's a bit of a scramble, and that's why we call it the scramble sheet. So have that at your availability, because we're going to refer to it. Okay? All right. So let's put that down, and let's get started. Excuse me. On slide 45. How did we wind up on slide 45? I don't know how that happened. Slide 41, it should be. Slide 41. With the types of mutual funds. We're going to go from the riskiest to the least risky. And the riskiest mutual funds, and there are others, but let's just stay with the major categories, are stock mutual funds. So we will now break down the categories of stock mutual funds from the riskiest to the least risky. Realizing that all stock mutual funds are risky because stocks are risky. But it turns out, as we'll learn in Chapter 5 and other chapters, that there are lots of different types of stocks, too. And some are more riskier than others. And so these mutual funds will invest in those more risky stocks and those least risky stocks. So have that scramble sheet available. And we'll start with the most riskiest stock funds. And those are aggressive growth funds. Actually, there's a couple of categories even riskier than this. Sometimes you'll see them, they'll be called Pro Series or Momentum or, yeah, Ultra. I'm not big fans of these. And aggressive growth stocks are highly speculative. There's that fancy word for gambling. They're seeking large profits from capital gains. Days rolling the dice, folks. They're really trying to create eye-popping returns. And what do we know about exactly increased risk? So now, if this analogy, this metaphor helps you, please use it. If not, just ignore it. I like to think of your mutual funds in your 401k and your Roth IRA like a buffet in English and French. And so when you go to the buffet table, do you fill your plate up with the most hot and spicy jalapeno peppers and cayenne-induced foods? No. Well, maybe some of you do, but most of us, we put a little bit of spicy food on our plate, right? And so that might be your choice for aggressive growth funds. Personally, folks, I don't own any aggressive growth funds. I don't recommend them. I just don't think they're in the best interest of the vast majority of investors. But if you have a taste for the hot and spicy, sure, have a little bit, 10%, 20% of your investments in aggressive growth funds. They might have very high turnovers, because they're buying and selling and trying to get in and get out. And that, to me, is not investing. It's speculating. Okay. The next category are growth funds. So these are mutual funds whose primary goals are capital gains and long-term growth. So they're going to typically invest in high-growth companies. They don't tend to be as aggressive as the aggressive growth funds, but some of them are, and some of them are quite risky. And others, no. They tend to go for companies that are growing at a reasonable rate, not outrageous eye-popping returns, but good growth over the long time. Sometimes you'll hear them say growth at a reasonable price. So, as we said, let's read at the bottom. Some funds have categories one or two more speculative than aggressive growth. One of them, for example, is called Janus 20. Now, Janus is the name of the company, and 20, I'm not sure if it's still around, but 20 was the name of the mutual fund. Now, why did they call it 20? What's a silly name for a mutual fund, isn't it? Well, if you recall from our first presentation, how many stocks must a mutual fund company have, according to the Investment Company Act of 1940? They have to have at least 20. They can't put more than 5% into any one individual stock. So in other words, these people are transmitting to you, they're speaking to you and saying, we are going to be highly concentrated. We are not going to have a well-diversified, broadly diversified portfolio of individual stocks. We're going to have 20, maybe 25. Now, that's great if they choose 20 good stocks, right? But it's the dual-edged sword. You live by the sword, you die by the sword. And so if one or two of those companies has a bad time and falls into a pool of tears, right, it's going to suffer. Now, what do you think of these strategies? Because it's going to get more complicated on the next slide. Capital appreciation funds. Now, how's that different from a growth fund? I mean, we're trying to grow the capital. Isn't that well, if you notice on this scramble sheet, I drew, to the best of my ability, capital appreciation funds around aggressive growth and growth funds. Why did I do that? Well, because they tend to be lumped in together. They tend to be spoken of in the same breath, but they're different. The difference is very subtle. These are mutual funds that seek long-term growth of capital. Okay, well, how does that differ from a growth fund? Most growth funds in their prospectus will have a provision that states, we will be invested primarily in growth stocks, usually staying between 80% and 100% invested in the market. However, capital appreciation funds don't have that stipulation. They can invest in anything they like, anywhere they like. So they could look at companies that are not growing, but just for some reason tend to be out of favor. Or they might be companies that are not considered traditional growth fund companies, for example, a food company, but the investment manager sees the growth of capital, the fact that they believe that the stock price is going to go up, as an opportunity. So they tend to be as risky as growth and aggressive growth funds, but not always. I like to think of them as painting with a broader brush than just a growth fund. If that makes sense, great. If it doesn't, because here's the problem. Some capital appreciation funds have names that associate them with growth funds. In fact, the largest capital appreciation fund is called the Growth Fund of America. It's one of the funds we looked at in the previous presentation. And you say, wait a minute, why did they call it the Growth Fund of America? If you went to the Growth Fund of America and said, but you're a capital appreciation fund, why'd you call yourself the Growth Fund of America? They would turn around and look at you and say, look, excuse me, we called ourselves the Growth Fund of America long before the term capital appreciation fund even came into existence. So you should change your name, not us. You see what you're up against? The well-known Fidelity Magellan Fund is a capital appreciation fund. And we will discuss the very famed investor, Peter Lynch, who ran the Fidelity Magellan Fund from 1977 to 1989 and racked up 29% a year. Hoo-hoo-hoo! He, it turns out, was just very, very well suited to just sniffing out opportunities for growth of capital, for the company to do well and the stock price to go up. And he didn't always choose growth companies. You see the subtle difference? And what's a growth company? What's in the, you know, we'll discuss that later on in chapter five, when, our next chapter, when we discuss individual stocks. That's one of the problems of doing mutual funds before we do stocks and bonds. So you got that? Growth, aggressive growth, capital appreciation funds, they tend to be all lumped in together. But the reality is, no, there are subtle differences that you, as a potential investor, need to sniff out. Slide 43. Now we get to the category that's my favorite, growth and income funds. These are mutual funds that seek both long-term growth and current income. Cool. Yeah, that's why we buy stocks, right? Capital appreciation, growth, and dividends, income. Primary emphasis usually is on capital gains. Sometimes they would own bonds to augment the income. And now here's another wrinkle. Sometimes they're referred to as blend funds. Sometimes they're referred to as value funds. But as we see on the slide, value funds often have a different wrinkle in their description and their strategy. Value funds typically seek stocks that are undervalued in the market by investing in shares that have low PE multiples and high, what are you talking about? Again, one of the problems of studying mutual funds before we study stocks, what is PE stand for? Well, it stands for price to earnings ratio, and suffice to say, we will discuss it in detail over the next few chapters. But a value fund will often look for companies that are out of favor with investors. So you have to be careful. You, again, have to scratch the surface and see if your growth and income fund is simply a fund that blends the growth of certain companies in their growth stages and the income from the dividends. Now, what category would we use for these with our buffet analogy? I like to think of this as the meat and potatoes, the pasta, the main entree. This is what you put the most of on your plate. 40, 50, maybe more percentage of your plate should be filled with growth and income funds. In fact, as a financial advisor, this is the category I normally recommend to people just getting started. They're going to go down when the market goes down. No doubt about that. But they're not going to crash and burn like their aggressive growth, and capital appreciation cousins. We want growth, yes, but we also love dividends. And we're going to see in Chapter 5, in our subsequent chapters about stocks, dividends don't lie. That's money in your pocket. And we will also discuss the very subtle and not so subtle distinction between growth and value in the investment world. It's a bit of a bugaboo that we've got to deal with, but later. Just know that value funds are often lumped in with growth and income, but not all growth and income funds are value funds in the way that many people use the term value, companies that are out of favor. Now, our last category for stocks is equity income funds. Now, again, why did they use the term equity income? Equity means stock. Income from stocks is dividend. So why don't they just call them stock dividend funds? No, they call them equity income funds so that the vast majority of people have no idea what you're talking about. That's what you're up against. That's why you are going to be the investment. Have I said that? I think I have. Okay, anyway, what are these equity income funds? These are mutual funds that emphasize current income and capital appreciation by investing primarily in high-yielding, income-producing common stocks. So what are some examples? Railroads, food companies, utilities, real estate investment trusts, which we'll discuss what they are later on, but they're basically a real estate company, and they earn rent, the shopping centers, warehouses, office buildings, apartment complexes. Are these kinds of industries growing rapidly, like the telecommunication? No. But are they going anywhere? Are the railroads going to disappear overnight? No, but somebody could come along, and next year Facebook is the has-been, and the new company takes, well, that's not, probably not going to happen. Some of you might have heard of AOL, America Online. Have you heard of them? Have you heard of Research in Motion? Blackberries? Yeah. No, Blueberry. What was it? Yeah, what was that cell phone that got obliterated by the iPhone? Yeah, that company's basically gone. So these are companies that are not going anywhere. They will also invest in bonds to generate income when the investment advisor believes that stock prices have risen to levels that threaten the preservation of capital. So we're investing in stocks. Yes. And they're going to be risky, but they're, when the markets get clobbered, as they did in 2000 to 2002, these held their own. Why? Because in the late 90s, people who invested in railroads and food companies were considered fuddy-duddies, old-fashioned, old economy. Some of you probably never heard that phrase, but if you were alive in the late 90s, you heard the new economy versus the old economy. But it turns out that they held up very, very well when the 2000 to 2002 bear market hit. Why? Because they had not participated in the insanity of the late 1990s. Did that save them in 2008? No. But in 2008, whereas aggressive growth funds fell 50, 60, 70%, growth and income funds fell 30, 40%, maybe 50%, equity income funds only fell about 30, 35%. You see the advantages and disadvantages? These funds, although they're stocks, they're going to go down, but they're going to hold up better than their counterparts in the more aggressive stocks. Now, what could we associate these with in our buffet? Oatmeal. I know oatmeal's boring, but it's good for you. It's good for you. There was a famous study where they took a bunch of guys and just fed them oatmeal for 30, 60 days for breakfast. And their cholesterol levels plummeted. And they said, look what the oatmeal did. Look what the oatmeal did. Well, it wasn't so much the oatmeal. It was the fact that they were no longer eating steak and eggs in the morning. But still, the oatmeal, look what it does for horses. So does that make sense? Go back over these five major categories with their cousins and brothers and sisters and study them, because now we're going to make it even harder. Slide number 45. Now we are going to overlay two other categories on top of the stock mutual funds. We're going to take a look at their size, their capitalization, which is a fancy word for how much are they worth. And that's why you see large cap, mid cap, small cap. Large cap being the largest companies, mid cap being the medium-sized companies, and of course, small cap. Which of these do you think these is risk? Which of these do you think is riskiest? Yes, the small companies are the riskier companies. Why? Because they just don't have the wherewithal. Their roots are not as deep in the economy as the large cap companies. And so when there's a major downturn, they tend to get clobbered. However, coming out of a recession, the small company stocks tend to do better. Why? Well, first of all, they got knocked down further, and the world changes. They are more easily able to adapt to those changes. Whereas the large companies are kind of like an oak tree, roots deep in the economy. They can withstand the storms, but then when there's an opportunity for branching out, they, you know, they're just, it's just a little harder for them to do that. And then on top of that, we're going to overlay yet another category, and that's the domesticity, which we've already discussed. Remember, domestic means companies based in the United States. Global means everywhere, and international, foreign, overseas means companies based outside the United States. And as we discussed back in our first chapter, it used to be that domestic were the least riskiest and international were the most riskiest, but it's not necessarily the truth anymore. The world is global. So now we have three different categories that we need to overlay on top of one another. And so if you look at the scramble sheet, let's see if we can pull that puppy back. We see that we've said, okay, look, look, look. It's a global large cap growth fund. Oh, it's a domestic aggressive growth, a small cap aggressive growth fund. And now you start to see why there have been so many mutual funds created over the decades. When one company came out with a global large cap growth fund, all of the other companies had to follow suit. And so we wound up with all these different types of mutual funds competing for your investment dollars. Cool? Okay, so those are the pick one from column A, one from column B, and one from column C. Now let's get even a little bit more esoteric and realize that there are mutual funds that invest in regions of the world. Mutual funds that just invest in Japan or Canada. There's at least one mutual fund that invests just in California. Well, that makes sense. If California were its own country, it'd be the fifth or sixth largest economy in the world. How about the Far East or Latin America? Now, I'm not a big fan of these personally. Why? Because what was one of the main reasons we purchased mutual funds? Diversification. So by limiting ourselves to a certain region of the world, we're concentrating. And that's okay. We can lump them in with our aggressive growth funds. We can say, okay, we want a little bit on our plate, you know, 5-10%, especially if you've been to the Far East or Latin America or Eastern Europe and you've seen the growth that's there and you say, oh, that's great potential. But still, don't fill your whole plate with this, okay? I'm a big fan of global funds, personally, because I want my money manager to go everywhere in the world looking for the best companies. It's not necessarily true that the best companies are based in the United States or Europe or even Asia. They might be in Israel or Turkey or Mexico. We can invest in emerging market funds. Again, the growth is there, but also so is the risk. Now, there are two categories, sector and market timing funds, which I really hope you'll stay away from, folks. Fidelity was the one that really pioneered this. If you go on their website, you'll see they have dozens of sector funds, which invest in companies based in a single sector of the economy. Wireless communications, leisure travel, mining and materials, healthcare itself is huge, so they invest in companies that do just one part of healthcare, such as medical devices or pharmaceuticals or hospitals. So again, we want diversification. However, if you know something about that sector, you work in the oil exploration field and you see that things are booming, go ahead, buy a little bit of this, but not a whole lot, right? And then if anybody tells you that they have a market timing fund, just say, yeah, fine. But no, you don't want it. We'll discuss about market timing and how it really is not a good thing to do or try to do. It's a famous saying by a famous investor of the mid-20th century. We'll come back to it. Don't try to time the market. It can only be done by liars. In other words, don't say, okay, market's ready to crash. Let's pull our money out. Market's crash. Let's put our money back in. No, 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 no. Okay, got it? So those are our stock funds. Now we're going to ease down the risk versus returns spectrum and take a look at bond funds, fixed income funds. And remember from our first chapter, bonds are loans. We're lending our money to entities, companies, state and local governments, the federal government, and they are going to be paying us interest and the promise to repay the principal. But again, there are gradations of risk. So we're going to go from the riskiest down to the least risky. The riskiest bond funds are high yield funds, sometimes called high income funds, usually referred to, not in print, but when we discuss them, as junk bond funds. And we'll discuss junk bonds in detail when we get to bonds. But these are companies that are usually in trouble, and they have to pay higher interest rates. Just as if you did not have a good credit rating, you would be required by the bank to pay a higher interest rate. Well, so too these companies, and sometimes municipalities, are required to pay higher interest rates just because their credit rating is not as good. Now, these funds tend to, instead of following bonds, the high yield, the junk bonds, they tend to follow the stock market more than they follow the bond market. Let's not delve into the reasons why, but just know that these high yield bond funds are the riskiest of the bond funds, and they tend to follow the stock market as opposed to the bond market. That's our spice on the bond side. The next category are corporate bond funds, and there are various gradations of these, various levels that we'll discuss later on when we get to how bonds are graded, how they are rated with regard to their credit worthiness. But most corporate bond funds are very straightforward, investing in high quality companies that have a very good chance. Just as most people pay their mortgages and their car payments, these companies will pay their interest payments and their principal payments. And some of them are convertible. Doesn't that sound exciting? Convertible bonds, kind of like a convertible car? No, not really. We'll discuss those later when we get the bonds. Now, the next category are the municipal bonds. State and local governments, municipalities, bridge authorities, water authorities, school districts like Southwestern Community College District, college districts. They are very popular with high net worth individuals. Why is that? Because the income is free from federal taxes. There's a reason for this. The Constitution of the United States says the states can't tax the feds can't tax the states. So if you buy a muni bond, a municipal bond, you're not going to pay federal income taxes on it. Now, you might wind up paying state income taxes unless you buy a municipal bond from your state. So here in California, if we bought a municipal bond anywhere in the state, doesn't have to be in our area, San Diego, but anywhere in the state, from a hospital, from a school district, from a city, a bridge authority, water authority, whatever, you will not only not pay federal income taxes, you won't pay state income taxes. So there are state-specific municipal bond funds, the California Bond Fund, whatever it is, that will invest only in Californian bonds, and that individual will not pay federal income taxes on the interest and not pay state income taxes on the interest. Very cool. And then the last category are the U.S.-backed funds. And the actual government issued bond funds. The U.S.-backed funds are backed by entities that were sponsored by the government originally. You may have heard of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. Well, for decades, many decades ago, the Congress sponsored these corporations. They were private corporations, and the government said, they're on their own, folks. They're an individual company, and you could invest in them, you could buy their stock. But there was always this implicit, unspoken guarantee that if anything happened bad to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the government would come riding in on a white horse and save them, even though all the Congress senators and House of Representatives said, no, that's not going to happen until 2008, when it did happen, when they got in trouble, just as anybody was involved in the mortgage market at the time. So you, dear students, are proud owners of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, just because you happen to be a tax-paying citizen. And the truth is, they've actually done pretty well. They actually are sending billions of dollars every quarter to the Treasury. Now, we don't normally want our government in the business of running corporations. It's not something that a market-based capitalist economy really wants to happen. And everybody agrees that they should be somehow extricated from the government, but nobody can agree on how it will be done. In the meantime, they are producing wonderful benefits for homeowners in the forms of low-cost mortgages. And so what congressperson in their right mind is going to want to kill the golden goose? It's a problem. And then, of course, the granddaddy of them all, the United States Treasury, government bonds, free from state and local income taxes. Why? Again, the feds can't tax the states, the states can't tax the feds. But the Treasury says, no, you have to pay us interest on our own bonds. So you see, we've gone from the riskiest, the high-yield bonds, through to the government-backed bonds, the least risky. And then we're going to do the exact same thing. We're going to overlay the two other categories on top of these five categories. And we have the first category is the time horizon, the maturity. When do the bonds mature? So we have long-term bonds, intermediate-term, and short-term bonds. Now, which do you think is the riskiest? Be careful. It has nothing to do with large cap, mid cap, small cap stock funds. No, that's something completely different. And people tend to think in that way, but it's the opposite. It's exactly what you think is the opposite. Short-term bond funds are the least riskiest. Long-term bond funds are the most riskiest. And why is that? Well, it has to do with the fundamental idea in finance. The longer the money is lent to an individual or an entity, the more opportunities for things to go wrong. That's it. That's the reason why if you get a 30-year loan, you pay a higher interest rate than if you get a 15-year mortgage on your home. Make sense? In fact, short-term bond funds and short-term bonds in general start to look like short-term investments, which might have a 6-month or a 9-month time horizon, where a short-term bond might have a 1-year, 2-year, 3-year time horizon. The closer you get to the maturity, the less risk there is. Of course, and what do we know about risk versus return? Long-term bond funds should pay us more over the long term than the short-term bond funds. Yep, that's how it works. And then, of course, the domesticity. Are they based just here in the United States? Most bond funds are. Are they global bond funds? Are they international bond funds? So we have the same old thing we looked at before with our scramble sheet. Pick one from column A, high yield, long-term, domestic bond fund. Or actually, I had a domestic long-term high yield bond fund. And now you see why there are thousands of mutual funds. Indeed. Our next category are balance funds. And balance funds are very cool, folks. For many individuals, they tend to be a very good choice to help us eat well and sleep well. These are mutual funds whose objective is to generate a balanced return of both current income and long-term capital gains. And they typically will invest in both stocks and bonds. The allocation is often 60-40, although it might change as the investment environment changes. One of the oldest balance funds in the United States is called the American Balance Fund. How's that for generic name, right? I love their prospectus here. They state that the fund is managed as the complete U.S. investment program of a prudent investor. Isn't that great? I like that. In other words, hey, if you're really frightened of stocks, but you still want to earn a good return over decades, buy a balance fund. And they're also excellent for people in retirement because they got some bonds and they got some stocks. And the American Balance Fund, and they're not the only ones, but they have this great strategy. They can never be more than 75% stocks, 25% bonds, when they believe that stocks are a screaming good deal, or less than 50% stocks, 50% bonds, when they think, you know, maybe stocks are a little overpriced now, we'll go 50-50. You see that? They stay balanced. And you might say, well, wait a minute, Payano, you said you're going to go from the riskiest to the least riskiest. If balanced funds have stocks and bonds, shouldn't they be in between stocks and bonds? Well, the answer is no. That doesn't make sense. Well, it's counterintuitive. Yes, I understand. But as we're going to learn later on, stocks and bonds, not always, but stocks and bonds tend to move in opposite directions. They are not correlated with one another. They are what we say inversely correlated. And we'll come back to this much later on. So a balanced fund will tend to have less volatility than a stock fund or a bond-only fund. Not always, you know, it's just that's in theory, because of the fact that stocks and bonds often move in opposite directions. Now, here's another wrinkle we're going to throw at you. Slide 49, asset allocation funds, huh? These are mutual funds that spread investors' money across stocks, bonds, and money market securities. They're very similar to balanced funds. However, the investment advisor often more diligently tries to fine-tune the allocation as market conditions change. Whereas the balanced fund will usually stay 60-40, 50-50, an asset allocation fund might try to move money into cash when they thought the markets might fall. They might try to move everything into stocks. And when they think stocks are a good deal, they might try to move everything into bonds. For all their hype, they tend to trail balance funds considerably because they may have timed the market badly. So to me, they seem like closet market timing funds. So I'm personally stay away from them. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't do your due diligence. But just remember, they're often lumped in together with balance funds, but there's a very important, albeit subtle, but a very important distinction. And I remember, I'll never forget, I told you about the investment advisors who came to Southwestern when the Nationwide on Your Backside took over, and they were talking about their asset allocation people and how they were, this was October 2002, and I'm pretty sure that the three-year bear market is coming to an end soon, folks. It's got to come to an end soon. And he said that they were totally in cash. And I knew that right then and there, I said, okay, the market's going to turn around. Because if these bozos are all in cash, that's a good sign. That means we're ready for the market to recover. Right. Anyway, enough said. Slide 50. And the last category, the least riskiest mutual funds, are the money market mutual funds. These are mutual funds that invest in short-term money market instruments. This is a review. We discussed these in Chapter 1. Much the same as money market accounts at banks and credit unions, but they are not guaranteed as a bank or a credit union can do with their money market accounts. There are general purpose, treasury bills, commercial paper, and then there are those that invest only in treasury bills, government securities, and then some that invest in short-term municipal securities, and these tend to be tax-exempt. They are essentially as safe as guaranteed money market accounts at banks and credit unions, since they invest in exactly the same securities, but they are not guaranteed. Did I already mention that? I think I did. And if you're so inclined, just type breaking the buck into any search engine, and you will see dozens and dozens of articles about money market mutual funds that lost a penny. That's how it works, folks. That's why it's called breaking the buck from a dollar to 99 cents. So know that your money's safe. Don't worry, your money's safe. What happened in 2008, there were two money market mutual funds, I think I told you this already, that broke the buck, and the Federal Reserve Bank came riding in on their white horse and said, don't worry, we'll take care of it. We'll backstop all money market mutual funds. They did that for 6 months, and then they did that for another 6 months, and by September of 2009, people were still frightened, but not so much that they were ready to pull their money market money out of their money market fund and put it under their mattress. Okay, slide 51. So we've gone through the mutual fund scramble sheet. Now let's take a look at slide 51 and mutual funds of mutual funds. You got to be kidding, right? No, these are very serious, folks. In fact, this is one of your assignments, is to take a look at Thrift Savings Plan and research some of their lifestyle funds, target date funds, retirement funds. They go by various names, and some of them are college-oriented. But you choose the fund that matches your time horizon. Say you're going to retire in 2050 or 2060 or 2030. You choose that mutual fund. And what does the mutual fund company do on your behalf? They populate the mutual fund with their own mutual funds that match the time horizon. And it says often, but it's almost always from the same company's mutual fund choices. And as the time horizon shortens, the mutual fund will change the mix of mutual funds. You see what's going on here? They are taking care of the fact that we're growing older. And as we grow older and closer to our retirement or to when our children go to college, we need to change our investment risk versus return portfolio accordingly. But they do it for us. And these are very popular in 401ks, 403bs. Why? Because if you join a company, they can automatically take 3-5% of your paycheck and send it into the 401k, providing they put it in the proper retirement account. You're 23, they would put it in the 2060 fund. You know, you're 45, they'd put it in the 2035 or so fund. And that way, they can't be sued. Because normally, if you're an investment advisor and you recommend an investment choice and it doesn't turn out well, you can be sued, right? And you need to have a license, first of all, before you do any kind of recommendation. And so before the Congress let these companies do this, the companies did not want to do that. They just did not want to set themselves up for a lawsuit. But now the Congress basically says, as long as you follow these rules, put the person in the proper retirement fund, then you can't be sued. And it's worked pretty well. It's, you know, it's not perfect, but it's actually worked pretty well. And you'll learn about these. The TSP, the Thrift Savings Plan, calls them lifestyle funds. Other people call them target date, target retirement, target risk fund. Yeah. Slide 52. Now, let's not spend too much time on slide 52 because I hope you stay far away from most everything on here. Maybe a REIT fund, but hedge funds. First of all, hedge funds are not legally mutual funds. They were traditionally only open to sophisticated investors, which meant you had to have $100,000 that you could lose and not commit suicide or whatever. But now you can get them with as little as $5,000 or $10,000, which I don't think is a very good idea personally, but I'm not in charge. They don't have any of the regulatory oversight that mutual funds do. What does that mean? If they wanted to put all their money on Netflix, they could do that. They don't have to have 20 different stocks or 50 different stocks. They could buy one stock. They can do things like shorting, which we're going to discuss later on, which you should never do, dear students. It's just too darn risky. But they get away with it. And they charge high, very high fees. So my advice, and again, you're going to hear people tell you differently, stay away from hedge funds. Bear funds, huh? These are mutual funds that are trying to make money when the market goes down. It's not easy. Why? Because the market goes up about three or four times more often than it goes down. Stay away. Precious metal, hard asset funds. These are mutual funds that actually invest in gold or gold mining or silver mining, other hard assets. And we'll discuss those later on. They're not the best investments in my humble opinion. Now, here's a category that might make sense to you. Real estate investment trusts. You want to be a landlord, but you don't want to buy real estate and remember the PETA factor for mutual funds? The PETA factor for real estate is very, very high. You could invest in a mutual fund that invests in real estate investment trusts. And what do real estate investment trusts invest in? Warehouses, office buildings, hotels, hospitals, other types of real estate. So the problem with REITs is that there's just not that many of them. So it's a sector fund, basically, and you're not really well diversified, even though you do own real estate. And then there are just dozens, hundreds of these boutique exotic funds, some of them just verging on the ridiculous. The stock car stocks funds. What do you think they invest in? Right, NASCAR. I have a hard time believing this, folks, but the biggest spectator sport in the United States, that means where people go to watch, is not football or baseball, it's NASCAR. Every week, 200,000 people run to a NASCAR, well, maybe after post-COVID, right, pre and post-COVID, and watch people race around the track at 200 miles an hour. And what do you see on the cars and on the hats and on the jackets? Advertising. So the stock car stocks funds invested in companies that were advertising with NASCAR because those people are nuts about NASCAR. Okay. What about the Paws Tombstone Fund? Paws is the name of the company. Tombstone's the name of the fund. What are they investing in? Pizza? Tombstone? No! Mortuaries! Cemeteries! Coffin manufacturers? Well, everybody's going to die someday, right? And thankfully, so did the Paws Tombstone Fund. And folks, you cannot make this up. This fact is always stranger than fiction. There was a mutual fund called the Chicken Little Growth Fund for people who were frightened that the sky was falling. Look it up if you don't believe me. There was the Timothy Fund for good Christians. There was a fund just for Muslims. I mean, yeesh. The choices are endless, and so are the fees. My recommendation is stay away from them. Okay, finally, we have to spend some time discussing index funds in more detail. Maybe we should make this in its own little presentation, because index funds have become the perfect fund, the perfect investment. And whenever I hear that, you know, all kinds of hairs jump in the back of my head, all kinds of red flags start flying. Nothing is perfect, dear students. We discussed index funds a bit in the previous presentation. They are passively managed. There's no active management performed. They buy and hold a portfolio of stocks or bonds equivalent to those of some list somewhere, some specific market index, such as the Standard & Poor's 500, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the Russell 2000. And we'll discuss these in detail in our next chapter. My apologies. But that's all they do, is they just look at the list. Why? They can offer much lower annual fees, no research, and many actively managed mutual funds don't beat the market, right? What's the problem? They've got to first overcome the fees that they charge you just to break even. Because of the annual fee of an index fund, though, the index fund cannot actually match the market's performance, but it should come very close, providing the annual fee is not excessive, whereas the actively managed fund, which we saw in the previous presentation, could substantially outperform or underperform the market index. You see? Now, the rationale on slide 54 for index funds came from research done in the early 1970s that statistically showed that many of the actively managed funds do not beat the market. They put these mutual fund managers up against a monkey throwing darts at a dartboard. In other words, they just randomly picked companies. And many of the mutual fund managers did not beat the randomly picked choices of fund of stocks. However, there are many actively managed funds that do beat their respective indices over substantial periods of time. You want to look for a fund family, and we'll discuss fund families in our next presentation, where most all the funds have consistently beat their respective indexes over decades. Don't show me 3-year, 5-year, even 10-year. I want to see how well they've done 20, 30, 50 years or more. And in the 1990s, index funds became a victim of their own success, as we'll take a look at on a slide coming up. But first, on slide 55, we see some of the indices that we will discuss. Don't try to study these now, folks. The only one you should remember is the Standard & Poor's 500, because that's the most popular one. But all these indices we will discuss in detail in our next presentation. Dow Jones Industrial Average, you hear about that every day. The U.S. Total Stock Market Index, what a silly name. They used to call it the Wilshire 5000. The NASDAQ Composite, the NASDAQ 100, the MSCI Global World, and IFA indices. We'll discuss these later on. But right now, what you're hearing is that index funds are the current perfect investment. For the fail-safe superlative treatment, go to ifa.com. There we'll tell you why index funds are the only way to invest. And I'm going to tell you differently. What are the downsides? Well, here they are. Slide 56. Indices are just a list, and they become skewed toward a particular sector of the economy or region of the economy or region of the world. For example, 1980s. Some of you weren't even around, but I was. And I remember people believing that Japan was going to take over the world. In fact, there was a song called I'm Turning Japanese. And if you don't believe me, look it up. And the Japanese market just skyrocketed. People just could not believe how high it had gone. So you thought you were getting a well-diversified international, foreign, overseas index fund by buying the IFA, the Morgan Stanley Capital International, Europe, Australia, and the Far East. And if you don't remember that, don't worry about it. It's not important. But that was the international index that people used at the time. It's since been replaced with one we'll learn in next chapter. And at the end of the 1980s, Japan made up 60% of the IFA. So we're talking Canada, Western Europe, a little bit of South Africa, Australia, Hong Kong. Who else was involved? Those were the biggies. And yet Japan made up 60% of it with a price-to-earnings ratio of close to 52. Now, again, we don't know what PPE is yet, but just realize that the higher the PE, the riskier the investment. Where everybody else, Western Europe, Canada, a little bit of South Africa, Hong Kong, Australia, Singapore, they made up 40% of the index, but with a PE of 13. Much lower, much less riskier. Well, Japan went on to lose 90% of its value over the next few years. The bubble burst, as it invariably does. You thought you were getting a well-diversified international index fund. You were heavily invested in Japan with their high prices. And the same thing happened at the end of the 1990s. The Standard & Poor's 500, the 500 largest, traditionally largest companies in the United States, became skewed towards information technology. And some of these companies you may have heard of, you may not have heard of them, CMGI, Nortel, AOL, DrCoop.com, all the internet bubble, internet companies. And then a few of the other information technology companies like Dell and Microsoft and Intel, they had been bid, their prices had been bid up to the point where fully 33% of the S&P 500 was made up of information technology, with a PE of 59, even higher than Japan. Whereas everybody else in the United States, now we're talking energy, healthcare, housing, food, distribution, everybody else was made up two-thirds, 66.7% of the index with a much lower PE. 19 is still, well, by now, by these days, it's not that high, but still pretty high. And what happened? The market burst in March of 2000. The S&P 500 went on to lose about 50% over the next 2.5 years until October of 2002, whereas the technology sector, as represented by the NASDAQ, lost 80%. So we're going to come back to this, folks, but just realize that no investment is perfect. Every investment has advantages, every investment has disadvantages. And a bonus assignment in Chapter 4 is to determine the size, the relative size, of the top 10 companies in the Standard & Poor's 500. It's an eye-opener. And I'm not trying to disparage these 10 companies, but it's an eye-opener. Stick with us. Slide 57. The success of index funds has bubbled over into exchange-traded funds. As we saw in our first chapter, these things are becoming very, very popular. Remember that they are open-ended mutual funds that trade like a closed-end mutual fund on the stock exchange. There is no limit to the number of shares like an open-end fund, but you buy them through your brokerage firm. And remember, if you buy them through the brokerage firm of the ETFs, say Vanguard and Fidelity being the two most two largest companies, you don't pay any brokerage commissions. Very cool. And as we also said, they've become very popular as trading vehicles because you can buy and sell and buy and sell throughout the day like stocks. Whereas an open-end mutual fund, they don't play that game. They say, look, you know, here's the price for the day. You buy it for the day or you sell it for the day. Most all ETFs are passively managed index funds. But now we're seeing more and more companies creating actively managed ETFs. So there'll be, right now when you say ETF, you normally talk about an index fund, but there are and there will be more actively managed ETFs. But the coolest part about ETFs, in my humble opinion, is they have cool names like Spider and Diamond and Cube. Okay, slide 58, socially responsible funds. You're hearing more and more about ESG, environmental, social, and governance, more and more about mutual funds that actively and directly incorporate ethics and morality and the climate change and all the other cool things about being a fuzzy-headed liberal like myself into the investment decisions. They started out with some funds refusing to invest in companies that sold tobacco or alcohol, and then they moved to companies that pollute, build weapons, nuclear power plants, destroy the rainforests, forests, and then on to companies that exploit labor, and it's surprising that there are any companies left to invest in, but the reality, silliness aside, is that these have done very, very well over the last 20, 30, 40 years, and why is that? Because they tend to be technology companies, which of course have done very well because technology has exploded over the last 30, 40 years. Not to be outdone, slide 59, there are now funds that are sociably irresponsible, possibly as a backlash to socially responsible funds and their perceived political overtones. There's a mutual fund called the Vice Fund. Yes, dear students, you guessed it. They invest in tobacco and alcohol and any other corporate nasties that you can think of. And although it's still a very small fund with high annual fees, it's actually done fairly well for its investors. I ain't recommending it. I ain't buying it. But check it out. If only to see that, yes, fact is truly stranger than fiction. And you wonder who would buy a mutual fund just because, I guess, if you really love tobacco and alcohol and you get tired of people telling you to go smoke outside, you'd buy a mutual fund that says, I'm the smoker. Slide 6. What is this? Well, this is, you can't read it. Don't even bother. But this is just a list of more classifications that you find in the Wall Street Journal, classified by a company called Lipper. Lipper and Morningstar are two of the big companies that research mutual funds. So we're just scratching the surface, folks. But don't try to learn everything that's on this slide. You can't even read it, first of all. But definitely go back over and study these categories, because I'm going to ask you, and you're going to want to know them, if only to, because you're the investment guru for your friends and families. And our last slide for today is an anachronism, really, because these have changed. But one of the reasons there are just so many different types of mutual funds is because of these style boxes that were created by Morningstar back in the 1990s. And Morningstar, a company that analyzes mutual funds, designed the style box to help investors identify investment alternatives. They say they're fabulous. Now, no one I know uses them, and neither do I. They now have ownership zones, which are basically the style boxes with ovals instead of boxes. And they say they're even better. And the reason I show them to you is not because I think you should use them. I don't think you should. I think you should investigate the mutual fund as the mutual fund, and with the techniques that we show you how to do. But because they created this style box, it made potential investors or investors think, oh, I need to have a mutual fund in each one of those style boxes. And so the companies obliged by creating a mutual fund in each one of those style boxes. I didn't think it was a good idea then. I still don't think it's a good idea now. But here we are, stuck with 12,000 mutual funds. So to review, go back over, study the major categories of mutual funds from the riskiest to the least risky. Realize that these are the coarsest, these are the most broadest categories, and that there are subcategories and sub-sub-subcategories and sub-sub-sub-sub-subcategories. But if you know these categories, you know the major investment alternatives in mutual funds. Cool? Cool. Now, in our last presentation, we will take a look at mutual fund families, a few more characteristics of mutual funds, and then we will zero in on a single mutual fund and see how that mutual fund has done over 80 some odd years. See you in our final presentation on mutual funds.